I'm really interested in the subject of men and compassion. That's really interesting.
Well, you know, and what I'm thinking is I'd like to hear some about the Fons Vitae Al-Ghazali Children's Project. Those are the kind of the two areas, and however it unfolds. So,
okay.
All right. Okay. Just let her rip.
Let her rip.
Hello, world. It's me, Dennis, and we are in search of the new compassionate male. I am the producer, and I'm here with the founder, Clay Boykin. Clay, take it away.
Hi, Dennis. You know, we have as our guest today Gray Henry, and she's the founder of the interfaith publishing house Fons Vitae and co-founder of the Islamic Text Society. Gray's life work is with Fons Vitae Al-Ghazali Children's Project. It's a far-reaching and compassionate effort that's changing lives all over the world. Gray, welcome to In Search of the New Compassionate Male.
Well, I'm delighted to be here. And I have a lot to say on that subject.
I would love to hear what you have, because one of the reasons when Clay started this project, he deliberately said, we're in search of, rather than that we've made it there and now we're asking everyone else to get there, because this compassion and masculinity and maleness and is such a rich and important subject.
Well, I'll tell a little bit about my background, which will help explain the way I come at what we're talking about, is that I majored in world religion, specializing in Hinduism under Joseph Campbell. He was my don at Sarah Lawrence. Mm-hmm. And I'm a big believer in the truth clothed in different clothing according to its time and era. But there are no two truths. They just are beautifully clothed by many different societies in different ways and different revelations and different traditions. And so I sort of woke up to being interested in ultimate reality through the Vedanta, because it provided a metaphysical underpinning for everything. And I didn't find that growing up as an Anglican, as an Episcopalian. I see, having published a wonderful book on the Kabbalah, that you have the Zephyrothic tree underlying with the divine principles. You have this in the Eastern Church, the essence and the divine energies. In Islam, you have Allah and the 99 names. So we're looking at underpinnings of a system which then gets clothed in, let's say, divine qualities, because we're getting into this with the compassion, right? That's why I'm bringing this up, is that in all the traditions, the divine is seen as, well, in Islam, as the all-merciful, the all-compassionate, right? And what we are all seeking, no matter what tradition you're in, is finally you want your creator to have mercy on you, because we are all miserable sinners in some way. You know, that's, I love the Jesus prayer of the Eastern Church. I love the prayer of the heart. But there were many people who are happy to say, Lord Jesus Christ, have mercy upon me, but not add most miserable sinner. But I mean, in a certain sense, our very separate natures make us not sinners, but separate. I remember the great Sayyid Hussein Nasser was asked, what is evil? And he said, it's distance from the source. Mm-hmm. And I think that really says it best, because the all merciful, all divine isn't dualistic. It's infinitely good. There isn't an opposite within it. But as we get distant from the spiritual center of ourselves, or if we get distant, the more distant you are from the time when a revelation comes, over time, it gets tainted and misunderstood. So the further you are from the source or from the ideal, true man in whatever faith tradition it is, that's what evil is, you see. So I'm just trying to get to this compassionate man thing. But I would say man is really, we're talking about true man. Let's go back to the essential essence in any one of us here together. Mm-hmm. And it's not male or female, but that divine essence, whether it's called Buddha nature, Christ nature, Adama, Phitra, the big self, you know, mm-hmm. that natural awakened primordial essence, which is our true nature, right, is compassionate because it partakes of that essence. And the thing we want most from anyone or from God is his mercy and his compassion. Yeah. But it's funny in life, people can tell you, don't be so lazy, be more generous. Those are sometimes hard to do, right? But someone can say, be merciful, be compassionate, and you can do it. Mm-hmm. You can smile to the person, you know, who's doing your checkout at the grocery. It's easiest to be the most real, you know? Yeah. And that's the thing that we are attempting to regain in ourselves. It's not regain, just we don't have to become compassionate. That's mm-hmm. who we are. And yeah. therefore, if we just quit doing all the junk around, I'm taking a very interesting course right now. I'm taking 3 meditation courses at the moment. And one is basically coming out of Tibet House, and it's 100 hours of work online and an oral exam and all the rest. The people are becoming meditation teachers, which I would not like to be. But we all have a circle of friends like you. We're together. Mm-hmm. And these are the sort of unsuspecting civilians in our life, you know, like my exercise teacher, right, who's in a rabbit hole. So the reason I took the course, I'm taking the course to be a teacher, is simply because I am a teacher. I've taught for years. I've taught world religions in Egypt, in England, at Cambridge, high schools, college. So I'm used to teaching it and publishing it. World spirituality is what Fons Vitae is about. But the reason is that if you have to teach something, you have to understand it. You have to be it, not know about it, but you have to actually be it. And this has been an incredible journey for me, this project that I'm doing right now, because I don't have time to do it. I work 13 hours a day with publishing and other stuff. But suddenly this thing has come, and you have to watch yourself. Why am I following through on this? I have hundreds of projects, hundreds of books, doctoral thesis unfinished. Why have I signed up for something like this with a bunch of groupies, you know, yoga teachers who are doing this, you know, and I figured it out yesterday. I'm reading the teacher's book, and it's called Awakening from the Daydreams or something like that, Awakening from Daydreaming. And he's basing the entire thing on a Tibetan painting. It's The Wheel of Life, which I've seen and filmed in the Asia Museum in San Francisco because I was so taken by it. But like all Tibetan stuff, I didn't get it. I mean, I've been to Tibet with Bob Thurman. I ran the Year of Tibet for Kentucky. I brought the Dalai Lama here. I've stayed at his brother's house in Dharamsala. But like Tibetan stuff, like those deities with the teeth, I don't like it. I don't like the chains of skulls because I guess I never bothered to figure it out. So here is this course based on this circle, the Wheel of Life, with a horrible toothy thing at the top with claws around the edges. And that is death of everything in the phenomenal world. You know, it's the impermanence of it all. And then in the center of this is the rooster, the snake, and the pig, and they're all tailed up. And these are the 3 things of grasping, holding on to things, wanting what your ego wants. And then the next level of keeping away everything you don't like, right? And lastly, just the indifference, you know, that we have, let's say, for the situation of racism in our town, right? And so then it goes out from this circle to 2 half circles. One is what takes you up and what takes you down. And then it goes into 6 realms. And they have horrible names, like the ghost realm or the ghost realm, but the God realm and the hell realm. And I'm thinking, what am I going to do with this stuff? So I started looking at these different realms. And what this is a picture of what the Buddha stood in his moment of enlightenment, of what is going on in our endless daydreaming, the different worlds we're going in and out of. And so because one of the tests on the final exam is what's going on with the six realms and what use are they? So I'm like a typical person doing my homework, writing it all out perfectly. And suddenly I started reading what each realm was talking about. And I started applying it to my own life, right? At the very beginning, what's the point of studying meditation or any spiritual tradition if you are not going to take stock of your own self, if you see what I mean? If it's all going to be just more talk, right? So I started looking at the different things, and I realized the reason I've been driven to do this course was when you get to the... You can't actually expect to go for being the compassionate self, right? Which is presence. It's no longer in all the egoic trips at every level. You're finally there, the awakened self that you always were, right? Or are, yeah. Right? And suddenly I saw, it said, if you have something going in your mind, there's somebody that really annoys you, you know, that, for example, you're maybe passive aggressive with them or vice versa. You've got to have someone in your life that you have a negative thing for, right? By the way, there is no way for you to realize the self of compassion if you even have that going at all. Meaning I started making lists in each of the realms of things I need to actively and consciously eliminate. And I'll tell you a beautiful story that goes back to this point. In 1989, His Holiness came to the Harvard Medical School. And I don't know at what point he said, and this in 89 was before he was going around Year of Tibet, entourages, guards, you know, he was available, you know. And he said, oh, we're here at the medical school, disease. Let's look at disease. It's dis-ease. He said, now I'm not talking about a baby born with cancer, but for most of us, the stress is what makes us ill. And he said, and I don't mean the stress that you've lost your job, that your wife leaves you, all the stresses we have. He said, the real stress. And it makes me cry to even say what he said, you know? And I feel it now. I'm experiencing. And he said, that stress that we are not aligned with our theomorphic essence, with that vertical plumb line that goes through each of us. And we all know we're not, even if you're thinking a negative thought, you're not there. If you're not completely generous with your cookies, right? You know it. And it's, you know, there are many ways of speaking about your conscience reminding you. In Arabic, it's the blaming self. You have three selves. You have the lower self, which thinks of itself first, like the egoic self. Then you have the blaming self, like the conscience that says, oh no, you really ought to visit the friend in the nursing home, right? But then you have the real self, the true self, which is the mutmainna, which is the soul that is content and at rest. It's the true essence. And it's watching, right? It's watching. When you're lying in bed and you think, oh, I'm going to get up at 5 a.m. and do some prayers or meditation. And then your lower self says, well, just stay in bed a few more minutes. You know, it's like in the Ghazali project, I had the child lying in bed and the mother comes in and says, get up for school. And the child thinks, I'll pretend to be asleep, right? But then the child also then has the thought, well, once I'm up, I'll feel fine, right? But there's something that can watch that. I mean, I can watch that conversation in myself. I can watch myself making the decision to do the right thing, then thinking I won't really do it. But so that self is the compassionate self that we're talking about. And it's aligned with our oneness of being. It's beyond the duality of men, women, or anything. It's the true essence of everyone. I had the great blessing of living in Egypt for 10 years. After Sarah Lawrence, I worked in filmmaking in New York City. We did all the psychedelic films for Timothy Leary, and we had a lot of fun, did the Buddha show and all the different shows. And then that wore thin. And although we were all looking for enlightenment, we all had Hindu masters. We all did the whole bit, right? And then I was married to a Venezuelan film director for a quarter of a century, actually, who was interested in saints and sanctification. And he wanted to be like St. Francis of Assisi. But when he mentioned this, in catechism classes, his priest said to him, to the boys, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" And they all said, "Doctor, lawyer, fireman." And Fyodor said, "That's not be, that's do. I want to be like St. Francis of Assisi." And the priest said, "But ah, my son, that is only for the elect." So he dropped out. He thought, "I don't need all of this masses, etc., if it's not headed for this point." And even as a child, I read and still continue to read Lives of Saints. I don't read fiction. And so, man, I painted triptychs, that kind of stuff. And so in the late 60s, he was reading in the New York Public Library, and he read a book about the living saints in North Africa, that every village had its living saint. And like, we're into the saints, like, yes, Mother Teresa has been canonized, but saints, like, aren't they dead and gone? There might be a lady who takes care of cats downtown. She may be a saint, but it's not the same thing where there's the known elder in the town where you go and sit if you have the aptitude for the full spiritual trip. And of course, in the Islamic world, if you want to do the full thing in the Christian world, Buddhist, maybe you become a Buddhist monk or a nun, right? You don't have to, but I mean, that seems to be a way of help, of a great support system. But in the Islamic world, there is no celibacy. You are expected to marry if you can, right? And expected to go for the whole emptiness, realizing the pure self with day-to-day life and commerce and life, in it but not of it. So anyway, he decided he wanted to sail across on a freighter to Morocco to check out the saints. And I was really interested in that too, but that's the whole point. That's the point we're talking about. I mean, if you think about it, I've often, when I teach high school, I say, you know, picture an ocean like this, right? And we can say that's a symbol for God, for ultimate reality. It's infinitely perfect, eternal, infinite. But that ocean throws up little droplets, like a little spray. And you could be Clay as a droplet, and Dennis as a droplet, and Gray as a droplet. And for a moment, Terry, we are separate. And we're up here in the sky. Think how many droplets we know who say there is no ocean, right? Even though we come from it and we're going back into it. When a person dies in the Islamic world, they simply say, "Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un." Surely we belong to God, and surely the return is unto him. That's what you say when a person dies. So here's a droplet, any one of us, and we've got an outer shell, a separative shell. Now, our essence is water. We've come from the ocean, but we identify with the packaging. We identify with our narrative. We star in the movie, and therefore we suffer. And that outer thing is temporary. It is not infinitely good. It is certainly finite, blah, 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 right? But our lives are focused outwardly on this shell that is destined to die, you know? It's like if you were going to move to France for the rest of your life, would you turn around and study Kentucky? You know, you wouldn't. But anyway, so the saintly person is the person who starts saying, "I am this, Tat Vam Asi." You know, I am identifying with their water essence to the point that all the way up to the edge of the little round ball, they have realized this is who I am. And there's no ego left. It's still encapsulated in the life finiteness, but there is no death for that person because they have finally entered into the pure, ultimate, compassionate self, right? You know, and that would be the quality of it, right? It in itself is probably beyond qualification, but in terms of what we can understand, There's a wonderful scholar called William Chittick in New York and out in Long Island, Stony Brook. He is the best scholar of Ibn Arabi and Rumi alive. And he wrote an essay for one of the books we publish. We publish Sufi texts and we publish inner spiritual texts of all the world's traditions. And in this, he pointed out that if you look out in nature, you see an oak tree. What qualities? Now, in the Eastern Orthodox, they speak of the essence and the energies, the qualities, right? And that in the Far East, the 1,001 things, or the 10,001 things, in Arabic, 99, none of those are exactly those numbers, but that's referring to something. So when you take, he said, when you look out and see a tree, it has verticality, strength, power, the all-powerful, right? A tree has branches and it's protective. Birds nest in there. It's protective, right? If you look at a daisy, it doesn't have those qualities. It has, you know, sweetness, delicacy. And different things in nature, animals, everything, are different proportions and different combinations of divine qualities. But when you say the name God, Yezu, Ram, Allah, the divine name contains all the other essences and qualities. So that when you say, if you're a person who does invocation with a mantra or a mala or prayer beads or rosary or whatever, I wrote a video once called The Universal Use of the Rosary, yes, showing how it's been used in all the traditions. But basically, when you say the divine name, that contains the entire manifested creation. That's a pretty far out thing to be able to do if you think about it. But there in essence, and what we can understand, you know, is the compassionate, the merciful, which it makes in something we can grasp, we can go for. But what I'm saying is that in terms of universal man or every man, or as Ibn Arabi would say, insan al-kamil, perfect man, that what we're looking at here is that if we could all make the effort in our spiritual meditations to sort of defeat the six realms of diversion and ignorance, and, you know, I mean, I can think of, you know, do I grasp? Well, I'll tell you occasionally. Once there was a title I wanted to bring out and some other publisher got it, I felt grasping. It wasn't exactly envy, but it was yuck, you know? And there it was, you know? So you think you're getting away with murder, but you're not. And so the Ghazali Project is really interesting. When I was 22 in New York City, I happened to read Abu Hamid al-Ghazali's Munkid Min al-Dalal, his book called The Deliverance from Error. And he lived from 1058 till 1111, big influence on Aquinas. And he his autobiography made my hair stand on end. I didn't know anything about the Islamic world in the 60s. It wasn't even taught at Sarah Lawrence in World Religions.
Really?
No. I wasn't included. I thought it was something like camels and harems and 1,001 nights. There was no oil discussion, you know. I mean, think of what you understood about the Islamic world in the early 60s. Nothing. There was some Pakistani who I knew who was into Sufism, but I just didn't even ask what it was, you know. And people weren't reading Rumi or any of that stuff back then.
Oh, no. We had the Ed Sullivan Show, and the guy that would do the plates, and they had a song called, music called Whirling Dervish. That was the only word I even knew, because they're da 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 da, and I didn't even know what that was. And that was my only, and I grew up in a very enriched, upper middle class, white, privileged area, nothing.
Well, we saw TV come in, Ed Sullivan, Zoo Parade, you know, Omnibus, the Roy Rogers or whatever it was. But I mean, so anyway, so with Ghazali, so I'm sitting reading my Hindu books, 42nd and 5th, pulled over this Ghazali's Deliverance from Error. And he said in his autobiography, "I'm on a crumbling bank. Up, up and away, if not now, when?" And what he was speaking to was, he was born of a poor weaver in Tus in present-day Iran. And his father died, but left money for him and his brother to be educated. And they had a very good teacher, Al-Jawini. And ultimately, Ghazali was so smart and so gifted that he became the smartest man in the entire Islamic world. He knew it all. He knew all everything. And when he would, when he was teaching at the Nizamiya in Baghdad, I mean, there was no one who could approach him with any argument, anything, because he had perfected all the languages. There's a time where you could actually know everything that could be known, believe it or not. Isn't that interesting? I mean, the books you could, and he started noticing he was teaching religion, but he noticed the pride in himself, you know, that, you know, he had, and then he had the thought, up, up and away, I'm committing spiritual suicide. I am a hypocrite. I am telling people not to have pride, and I'm experiencing it strongly in my heart. And then he had the thought he should leave. But then he thought, I have a wife, I have position, I have two daughters. I'm the creme de la creme. Then one day, God in his mercy and compassion, right? When Ghazali went in to teach his class, his voice was taken away and nothing came out. And the doctor said, there's nothing physically wrong with you. So he bade goodbye to his wife and daughters to make a pilgrimage, right? And he went to Damascus, and he got a job as a janitor in a mosque. The temptations when he heard people talking to correct them or to tell them were wrong. But what he realized, now this is the 1000s, Islam gets going about 620, something like that. So it's we're 400 years into Islam, right? And he says, my beautiful faith tradition is going literal. This is 400 years in, you know, people are following it literally, and it's not literal. It relates to infinite, divine, you know, everything, inner meanings. So he wrote in 10 years, he wrote 40 books. It's called the Ihya Ulumuddin, the revival of the revivification of the Islamic sciences. And he goes from what is learning to death. And he went through the entire Islamic faith tradition. And it's, by the way, any faith tradition. It's utterly universal stuff. And he puts back in the inner meanings of the whole thing. And this, I've seen one of the originals in Sarajevo, in the one of the great libraries there, you know, that was written at his time. But these 40 volumes, right? Of course, in Persian and Arabic. And over years, we've seen bits of them being published by in Pakistan, different places, different qualities, different strengths, because you can't have somebody who's a translator or an engineer translate Ghazali. If you don't get that, if that's not where you're at spiritually, how in the world do you know what he's talking about? You see what I mean? So, when we had 10 years in Egypt, we drove from Tangiers to Cairo. It took 8 or 9 months driving across the desert. And my daughter was delivered in Libya by Bedouins with tattoos. It still had a king. My grandfather had been in Egypt from 1925 to 52. He was a judge at Oxford, and he was one of the two American judges in the mixed courts of Egypt. They had Farouk and Fouad had... of course, all the Western countries were trying to grab a part of the Suez Canal. Of course, we were all out there grabbing other people's stuff as usual.
Ah, yes, the bloody colonial.
Yeah, and we should be so ashamed. And so he had been out there for 27 years as a judge with my grandmother from 25 to 52. And my godfather, Judge Brinton, was still in Cairo. He was there 40 years. So we were going out to seek saints, right? And found them, right? There are. It's not, you can't read about this stuff if you don't sit in front of someone who's gone, who's utterly present. You don't know what you're looking for. It's an amazing thing how important it is. You can read a million books of all the great stuff, and we've all read it, and I've published tons of it, but it takes actually the presence to say, that's what I want exactly. It's conveyed as presence, not as vocabulary. Anyway, besides all that, we were out in Egypt for 10 years, and then we thought, oh my God, Theodore worked doing films, and we went around the entire Islamic world with our children, visited the Muslims in Taipei and Kyoto, you know, Indonesia. We started thinking, God, what an incredible civilization that we've never known anything about. Even when I majored in art history and world religions, but everything is vertical. It's all Eurocentric. Mm-hmm. The caves of Lascaux, forget the caves, were going on in China and Argentina at the same time in the Paleolithic period. We know nothing, right? So the way everything was taught was Euro up, and maybe there was something going on in India. I think they're doing better with that today in China, but we didn't know anything. So therefore, we had no knowledge of this part of the world, literally.
It amazes me. You know, yeah. When we think of the richness that came from Persia, Persia was this extraordinary civilization. And now we look at Iran and we look at, I feel like we're walling ourselves off from such richness if we would just be able to have a change in mindset.
I've been there 3 times. It's fabulous. The people are fabulous. They're really suffering under all of this. The most beautiful buildings in the world, you know, it's amazing, right? And to think that we're like, threatening, and the whole thing with the nuclear thing. I mean, I can't even think about it. So ghastly.
This is Persia. This is Persia, for goodness sakes. This is Hafiz and Rumi and so many things.
Terrible.
You know, you bring an excellent point, because in our search, I have this sense, I'm getting this sense that all of this downward pressure that's happening, that to your point, our essence is compassion. You know, I express it saying our essence is love, but I have trouble getting my arms around that idea of love. But compassion is love in action, like you were talking about. It's action. I can do that. And what I am feeling is that this downward pressure is getting to a place where this compassion is pushing up.
Yeah, I think
and
so.
It's just about to pop in a good way.
We can't take it any longer, you know?
That's right. That's right.
Beautiful.
That's right.
Richard Rohr. Do you know Richard Rohr?
Oh, gosh, yes. I follow Richard.
Mm-hmm. I love Richard Rohr, and I really do. I attended one, because I'm very involved with Thomas Merton. I got back to Louisville from 10 years in Egypt and 12 in England, and got back here so my parents could die in the home they built. I'm living, sitting in my father's chair, as a matter of fact.
Oh, wonderful.
He built this house when I was in the second grade. And so I came back so that they could die in the home that they built and taught. And then I got mixed up with the Thomas Merton Center, creating that at Bellarmine. I didn't know anything about Merton, but I soon did. And, have done a lot with Gethsemane, but I have a series called the Fons Vitae, Thomas Merton series. It all began when somebody lent me all of his Sunday talks were recorded, where he talked to the novices for half an hour. He never talked about Buddhism, but the last 2 years of his life, he talked about Islam and Sufism. And I were listening to these tapes when I was teaching at a university called Setter in Danville. It was a long drive. So I listened to Merton talking, and he's an Aquarian like me. And many times I thought he was like over the top, or he was so funny, I stopped and laughed, or he was so right, I stopped the car and went over the steering wheel and wept. And I fell for him. I mean, I know him and I love him. And then I was up at a Congress at Notre Dame with a man, the son of someone. There was a man called Louis Massignon, an incredible Catholic who got his faith back from working in Algeria with the Muslims. He had gone agnostic or atheist or something. And he was so Christian at the end that one day his wife came and said to him, he's very elegant, Massignon. She said, where is your good suit? He said, well, I gave it. Someone came to the door. And she said, but it was your best suit. Now listen to what he said. He said, but we give our best. Wow. Right? He did it. He made it. Massignon's son was up at Notre Dame and there was some conference on something. And I mentioned to friends Sidney Griffiths and others about the Merton tapes. They said, well, why don't you do a book called Merton and Sufism, The Untold Story? So it went from that to Merton and Judaism, Buddhism, Taoism, Protestantism. We've done them all. Confucianism is coming out right now. We did the indigenous wisdom last year. And then Hinduism, we're going to end with Hinduism. When I read that life of Ghazali when I was 22, that he went through with it. He realized, like we, all of us, the three of us, and everybody, all of us, we are all on a crumbling bank. And if we do not get into this point and be that compassionate, up, up, and away, we've lost it. We blew it. We blew the human state. We literally have blown the human state. And we're all getting older. And, you know, I think I thought if I just published enough books about spirituality, I'd finally be spiritual. Not true.
We were talking about the pushing down of compassion and how it's bursting forth because it has to.
It has to, yes. We've hit the breaking point, the tipping point, you know. And I think the COVID has made us more aware of others, the suffering of airplane people, the people in India. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's really brought us to a universal suffering, and the racism thing all happening at the same time. I mean, look at Kentucky with Breonna Taylor and the whole business. Yes. I mean, and we can't get away from it anymore, you know. I think
are you seeing one of the things that we're seeing, because so many of the people who listen to this In Search of the New Compassionate Male identify as women, because we're really seeing the rise of women and the women. And this is so important to us because we realize that we, because as white males, when I was growing up, there were only men in the room. There were only men at the boardrooms. There were only men. We are still way overrepresented. And it's really important to us to bring more of the divine feminine, both in ourselves and into everyone where we are.
Yeah, you know, even when you see, you know, my husband and I are watching a 450 episode Turkish series on Netflix. You know, it took a friend of mine 2 years to see it. My daughter and her husband, because of the COVID, finished it in 3 months. But it takes place in the 1200s outside of Erzurum and Aleppo, and it's the yurt culture, right? And the women are making all the incredible rugs, and the men, well, they're luckily it's just bow and arrows, right? And swords. And Ibn Arabi comes on the scene, and it's the son of the hero, who is Erdogan, will become the founder of the Ottoman Empire. So we're interested in the history part. But the men are all happy to go out with swords and defend, and the women are doing the rugs. And that seems to, you know, my husband's very excited about those parts. He falls asleep when it's just the comp, but he likes the battles. So we have running our countries all over the world, people that are ready to gear up for that, right? And women wouldn't do that. You know, we're the nurturers. We are your mothers, right? Yeah. Can you imagine us and, you know, wanting to rush into, I went to Central Asia some years ago. I have a yurt in my backyard, a beautiful yurt with an entire interior from Kyrgyzstan. And when we were in Kyrgyzstan, yeah, there was a statue in the central plaza of the queen, the Kyrgyz queen, with her felt cap or crown, right? And usually men on those horses, you know, King Louis, you know, you don't see women on horses in the centrals of squares, right? So the queen is on everything, right? Her image is on curtains and on dishes. So if you finally have to say, well, like, what's going on with the queen, right? It's not just the queen. There's more to it. All right. When, you know, Russia came into Central Asia and took it over, and the Muslims had to go underground and hide. They couldn't have a religion, and many terrible things happened. And in the end, as they took over, the Kyrgyz queen, she made a truce with the Russians. She made peace and agreed to things, right? And her son, the prince, being a man, right, couldn't bear it. And one night he snuck out and slew a Russian army officer. The peace is broken. The treaty is broken. Mm-hmm. Now, she built a dais, mm-hmm, and all her people and the Russians stood around, the Russian officers, the Russian people. And she had a gallows, and she stood there with her son. And she said to her son, and everyone listened, My dear son, you did what you did for our people, and I now do what I must do for our people to preserve the peace. And she strung him up. Look at that. God. That's compassion. Yeah. Finally. Yeah. She went beyond her egoic love of her son to peace for her people. And guess what? The Russians are gone today, and they got their country back, and now they're doing their thing. Patience. We can't be patient if we don't trust there's something to be paid. There's some end that is real and that is something that can come about.
Do you feel, Gray, in this connected age when you can, I mean, we've gotten a chance to do podcasts with people in Tanzania and Sardinia and all around the world, that consciousness has been let loose, that something very positive is happening in our ability to connect. I realize that everything's a double-edged sword, but there appears to us to be an impetus.
I think so, but you can't tell. Maybe every age has this, you know. Maybe everything is just a repeat in different clothing. Is that I have a friend, Hamza Yusuf. He's the head of a university in Berkeley called Zaytuna. And Hamza Yusuf, he one day said, you know, the children in the Islamic world, they're being educated. They're just memorizing stuff, you know, memorize scripture, do this, do that. Don't forget to do your prayers, all the rest of it, right? But it's all about doing and not understanding the inner meaning of it, the transformative spiritual meaning. He said, you know, you really, and I've been publishing Ghazali for years. In England, we did the book of death, and we jumped around because we now have access to the 2011 most incredible critical edition, all in leather, of the best of all the Arabic manuscripts. It's all together. So we're using that and doling it out to scholars to put it into English. And then I take the English, this took 8 years, took the English while the editors are working on it for another 3 years, making sure every reference point is correct, everything that's quoted in scripture, that it all is true. And then I took these books, which are way over my head, by the way, and then read through and circled all the key points, and then selected the scriptural passages to use and the stories. Now I see where Rumi got all of his stories. They took my everything from Ghazali. And then I had to sit down and figure, how am I going to say this to a six-year-old? Can you imagine taking metaphysical theology? These books were written for theologians, not for children. And I found what it did was I had to put it into the language that I actually speak. When you're thinking, you're not thinking the transcendent yet imminent. That's not the way you think. You think, oh, haste makes waste when you fall over the wastebasket, right? So the language we speak in ourself is not highfalutin. It's simple. So I realize if it can't be said in children's language, if it can't be understood at that level, it can't be understood. And it was a gift to me, because by having to do, I've done books 1 through 7, and I got a grant from the Templeton Foundation for $750,000, and then raised another $500,000, because printing these children's books and these workbooks and these teachers' manuals, and guess what? You won't believe it, but they have gone in. We finished 2 years ago, but I just finished the last book on pilgrimage during COVID. They've already gone into 14 languages. The president of Pakistan ordered the whole set. The Urdu is done. It's gone in, it's going into Uzbeki. Of course, it's in Swedish, Danish. What in the world do you think is going on? Is the this is part of what you're talking about too. The desperation of not knowing the inner spiritual transformative meanings. And I'm telling you, when you hand this to children, it's saying the same thing as this Tibetan thing, okay, that's so hard to understand. It starts out, Ghazali, I'll pretend you all are 5 years old, okay? All right, I'll give you the first 4 chapters that Ghazali wrote for scholars. He said, did you two know that the 2 kinds of learning? And the children like, what? Yeah, like practical learning, 2 and 2 is 4, physics, health. Oh, but then there's the real, the special, the real learning. And then the children think, oh, well, what's that? That's how to polish your heart. What? Oh, you didn't know you have 2 hearts. You have the physical one that pumps the blood, and then you have your real heart, your golden heart. And that's what we know in every tradition as the Buddha nature. It's the whole, it's the heart. And how many traditions use the heart? The sacred heart is their symbol anyway, the heart, the core, right? So they say, oh, so the real special learning is how to polish your heart. Well, how's it get dirty? Oh, you know, if you backbite, if you're not kind, if you're selfish, if you don't share, you know, never mind the extensions of that. And then the children say, but why would you have to polish it off? Oh, didn't you know there are 2 worlds? This world we are in right now is brief, right? And it has many trials and difficulties, but they're there to use to polish your heart with. They're all opportunities, and everybody gets a different tailor-made package of problems, challenges, trials. But those are there to polish your heart, because this world is really short. It goes really fast. And then there is the next world, which is forever, and that's utter contentment, utter satisfaction. Well, every tradition has images of hells and heavens and rivers and all the stuff. But I think that state of being of the ultimate compassionate, reaching the highest level of the qualities of God, or whatever you want to call God, right, is that if you've your little ball that's up here out of the water, if you've become solidly inside, empty of all but your true nature, right, there is no death, there is no desire, there is ultimate satisfaction, is ultimate contentment. Who knows what enlightenment is? Who knows what realms are? We don't know any of this stuff, but you can see how what that could mean is the same thing. Right. So the children, if they're at a level where they have to see something or have an image of a garden with a fountain or trees, fine. And that will last them till they can't deal with that one anymore, or it will last forever. And it's a great allegory or great metaphor or the truth. Who knows? Right. So then you've already told a child who's 6 years old everything they need to know. Your true nature is pure. So when people tell you, you're no good, you're naughty, you're going to hell, whatever it is. No, that's not your true self. That's just stuff, you know, stuff that you have to work on, stuff that you can get rid of. And, oh, all the difficulties you're going to be having in your brief life, these are all spiritual opportunities, right? It's like unreal. When Ghazali goes into the level and nature of arguing, oh, my God, what it is, if you can, because you... He gives 10 things you absolutely cannot do, ever. And backbiting, gossiping. Look at the world. Look at what people talk about. Can you believe it? And in the Quran, and I didn't know whether to put this image in the children's book, God likens backbiting to eating the dead flesh of the person you're speaking about. And I thought that might, I've never read the Quran in total, but I thought that has got to be the worst image I've ever, and maybe hell images are worse. And I thought, can I put this in a children's book? And I thought, I'm going to do it. So I put it in. And that afternoon, I rewrote the section on backbiting 22 times. And then I was going out to see some lady friends. We were having dinner at a restaurant, and they were all talking about a friend of mine's father. It was horrible, right? And I decided to tell a really funny story about how horrible this was. When I got in the car to drive home, I felt queasy, and I ran into the house, and I threw up because I got through it. We are so veiled as to all the deadly sins. We are just getting away with murder. We don't even look at it. We don't observe it. We're not doing anything about it. We're edging off into stealing a pencil here and there. I mean, this stuff is real. And so then I couldn't do it anymore. It stopped. It's over. Because I Ghazali takes you all the way to the core of these deadly sins. And we need to do that. And I have a Christian friend. She's an Eastern Orthodox, and she did the illustrations for the Book of Prayer, one of the books. And she said, as she was reading it, she said, oh my God, why weren't we taught this in Sunday school? We don't know how. We not looking at this stuff. And I can remember my mother saying, dear, if you don't have something good to say about someone, don't say anything at all. She should have said that 10 times a day. It's so dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
And we live in a world of slander.
You mentioned mother. I wanted to ask you. So the children are being taught with this.
Okay, yeah.
The children. How are the parents handling this?
They are learning it too.
Wonderful.
Yeah, and like I'm teaching at 5:30 today in a half an hour. You know how many schools are going on all over the world? We have 450 pilot schools in Pakistan in the rural area. The children are really poor, and you should see the murals and the games and the activities that bring all these ideas home. It's unreal. And on I'm teaching. Some parents called me from Turkey, and some Macedonians and Bosnians, and they asked if I could find a teacher for their 8 children. Well, in the end, I said, I'll just teach them because I can't find anyone. But then I do teach on Sunday mornings, kids from Dubai simultaneously, kids in London. But I mean, I'm not really there. The schools are doing it themselves, right? But every so often, it's interesting to get on and see how little tiny children get it. Sometimes the 5-year-olds get it better than the teenagers. Because it's universal. One of the things that's really interesting is Ghazali says, if you have a good thought, right, act on it right away, because the whisperings come right in. Mm-hmm. I can remember once I had a thought to call this scholar I knew in England every day. And he was old and not well. And I would think, oh, it's 5 hours ahead. I'll do it tomorrow. And then the thought, call him, Gay Eaton. And I think, well, I'll do it tomorrow. The third day when the thought came and I called, he had just died. We're all connected up. Oh, it's, you know, those thoughts when you have a good thought, call up the grandmother. You need to, because that's not coming from you. Ghazali says the thoughts are angelic, the good thoughts. Mm-hmm. So what a game we do with children is, one child stands and gives a good thought, and the other one pretends to be the whisperer. Oh, go and watch TV instead, right? And then they play this game, but then you get them to give their own thought and their own thought that tells them not to do it. And then what happened is, after I did this with kids for a while, when I have a good thought, like stop at the nursing home as I'm driving by, it has a kind of a day glow yellow circle around it, like good thought. Because normally they're all mushed into the other thoughts. Did I pick up the dry cleaning? I'll get lettuce right now for dinner. And all of these thoughts. So the good thought comes and you feel it because the real awareness, the real self saw it.
So true.
But we just let it fade. But with that good thought thing, now it's like outline. And I'm afraid not to do the good thought immediately now.